Hey everyone, welcome back to the Contextual Insertion Podcast. I'm your host, Aaron Smith, and I'm once again here with Tech Bro Tito.
Nostrovia.
So, Tech Bro, so we were having a discussion earlier today, and we wanted to sit down and get it on the podcast and kind of share some of our thoughts. You know, we were talking about riffing on the Civil War and the disconnect in America between different factions, and we're talking about the Josh Hawley and the UC Berkeley law professor case. Do you want to jump in and share your thoughts?
One of the things America has trouble with is the idea of always working things out together and stronger together and such. My name, Tech Bro Tito, is of course a reference to Josip Broz Tito of Yugoslavia. You know, depending on how old you are, you recall the Yugoslav wars of 1990s, Bill Clinton, the bombing, Sarajevo, the various massacres, as it were. And this was because Yugoslavia was a state that was composed of different peoples that were brought together under strongman, Josip Broz Tito. And basically everyone knew when Josip Broz Tito was gone, Yugoslavia was on borrowed time. It lasted about 10 years before Yugoslavia erupted into worst war seen in Europe until at least Ukraine, and still probably worse in many ways, ethnic cleansing. There was Srebrenica, which is considered the largest ethnic cleansing since World War II, or genocide. I believe about 5,000 killed due to ethnic and religious position, you know, rounded up and executed. It's a difficult position. Everyone's talking civil war, but why are we talking civil war? This is why what I wish to discuss. People end run to civil war, why civil war, Tim Pool, etc., etc. This is not meant to be, let's go for clicks, let's try to get clickbait. This is a question of what leads to a society that's unable to resolve differences, and why, and what signs you might see. So, issue in Yugoslavia, again, is that you have different peoples that were united under strongman, and strongman was able to basically hit everyone equally enough that everyone had to get along together. Saddam Hussein's similar principle. He manages to keep people together, actually from a minority ethnic position, manages to keep country together by being a strong man and doing violence to people that would step out of line. Josip Broz Tito did the same, but also kept a relatively relatively affluent country. When he was gone, though, no one had the ability to keep everyone together. So what we're talking about with Josh Hawley and Chiara Bridges, UC Berkeley law professor, and if you haven't seen it, it'll be linked in episode, but there was exchange about if a woman could, you know, if abortion or if pregnancy was a woman's issue. And the disconnect here is that, you know, many people will see this and say, well, the left has gone crazy, and so they're just going to be slaughtered in midterms, yada yada, the swing of the pendulum, you know, peak craziness or whatever. And what will happen is people will reach their senses and realize left is crazy and will tack back. But the issue is, you know, this requires enough people to agree upon what your position is, to agree upon, yes, they've gone too far, yes, I agree on that. Whereas the thing that I think people miss is that Josh Hawley was talking to his base and trying to reach out to middle, but Chiara Bridges and the sort of left and sort of on the trans issue itself, if a man can give birth, etc., etc., she is talking to her side, and they're not having the same conversation. And can you have a conversation? Can you have a same agreement if you completely disagree on the moral implications? You know, very much what happened with civil war in your country. Yeah, you know, in large part, it came down to a Fugitive Slave Act. You know, if slaves escape up north, does North have to return them as stolen property, or can they be freed? And can the North thumb nose at South and say, no, it's not stolen property, it's a moral issue? You can only really have one, and sometimes one has to win out. And so if you have a position where Josh Hawley, you know, is literally killing people, or you know, is literally killing people by not saying that men can give birth, does free speech trump, or does safety of people trump? And it is a mutually exclusive issue. So I'm going on a bit long, I'll let Aaron jump in, basically. But, you know, just last point, going back to the 90s, you had, you know, what was referred to as sister soldier moment by Bill Clinton. The Democrats had been out of power for a very long time, you know, they'd been slaughtered since Carter basically made them look like idiots and all this kind of stuff, Reagan, and Democrats were in wilderness for many long years. So there's a sister soldier starts insulting, is, I believe, a hip-hop or rap artist, and she starts going after white people for their race, at which point Bill Clinton speaks up and says, no, you can't do that, that's racist, that's wrong, and calls her out. I believe Jesse Jackson steps in, but he has a sister soldier moment where he confronts radical left, and it's seen as that Democrats were stepping up and being willing to patrol their own, based off of a morality that Democrats would side with, call it the great middle, and side even with Republicans insofar as you can't attack someone based off of race, regardless of race, even if white. And this was seen as a grown-up moment. This was seen as a moment that that Bill Clinton really took back Democratic Party and made it irrelevant again. The issue is, can you still have moments like that on either side, really? Or, you know, are both sides too interested in talking to their base that simply have positions that there's no compromise on?
Yeah, it's an interesting topic. You know, we were one of the things too that I think that which is deeply ironic here in a way that we're worse off than what they were dealing with during the Fugitive Slave Act, because at least then everyone sort of agreed on what a slave was. There wasn't anyone going, no, you can't say the word slave. This is not a slave. This is just a differently employed person. There was no debate about what the word slave meant.
Contractually challenged
people. Yes, the contractually challenged people. There wasn't anything like that. But it was so fascinating, too, because like you said, we had this exchange between Joss Hawley and Kiara Bridges. And again, she never said the word woman. She kept saying, like, people who can experience pregnancy. And he's like, do you mean women? He's like, I mean people who experience pregnancy. And he's like, can a man get pregnant? And she was like, you're being transphobic and all this sort of stuff. And it was really interesting to watch because, again, you know, these are people who cannot even use the same language. They're speaking English, but the words that they're using mean fundamentally incompatible things with one another. And another thing about it, like, again, you know, so many people, like, immediately after that happened, it was deeply ironic because both sides were sharing the same clips and saying, look, you know, Ms. Bridges, like, slay queen, she, like, showed that transphobe Hawley. What fur? And then everyone's like on the right, like listen to Hawley handle this lunatic, you know. But everyone's watching this same video and taking away the same thing because, again, you know, they're using this is two groups of people that are speaking fundamentally incompatible language.
Taking away different thing, not taking away same.
Well, things. No, taking it's the same exchange, the same clip, the same words, but they're taking fundamentally, yeah, like you said, different. They're looking at it differently. It's two incompatible worldviews that don't even. They're using the same words, they're speaking the same language, but the words and the definitions and the intentions behind them are, like, radically incompatible. Like, unintelligible to each other.
It's Scott Adams watching the same movie on two different screens.
Yeah.
Or it's different movies, same theater, as it were.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and the interesting thing about that to me, when you're looking at it, is, and to kind of riff on this a little more, I mean, well, another thing, too, is a couple of things. Like, so much, you know, I was talking about this. Let me go back to this other part. Fundamentally, what you're really seeing is, you know, people have been talking about national divorce a lot more lately, like national separation. And I kind of think the point people are missing when they talk about national divorce is they assume it's something that happens in the future. It's a legal process by which two people split off, when I think it's not really that. I think national divorce in the context of modern, you know, current year, and even back then, it's more of a lagging thing, like in the sense of it's a realization that two people, that or I should say specifically, it's a realization that one group of people, that everyone, there has been one group of people, is now become two, has been cleaved into two groups. And the legal construct of national divorce or splitting up is more of a realization of current reality than it is something that fundamentally changes. Like, and when I watch that, I'm thinking it's like, you know, if the country splits up or decides to have, you know, states go their own, different states join together and go their own ways, it's not going to be creating something or changing things. It's just simply going to be a belated realization of the state of play on the ground, which is, you know, these two fundamental, you know, we have two groups of people at the very least who share a geographical space and a political construct that have nothing really in common anymore. They don't even speak the same language. You know, how long is that really going to last? And that's a big part of it, you know. But I think another thing, too, that's really interesting, and, you know, I was talking about this earlier. Lawyers, and apologies to my lawyer friends and lawyer fans that are listening, but, you know, being a lawyer is like the epitome of a word cell, you know. And if you look, and, you know, if I'll share this, it's like the, it's sort of as an internet meme joke, but it's kind of an interesting sociological study of humanity and the different types of people. There's like word cells and shape rotators, and word cells are people who like focus on like abstractions and you know, social constructs. And there's the shape rotators, which are more like engineers and people that work with concrete reality. They can picture things in their head, they think visually and can rotate shapes in their head because they're planners and designers and spatially gifted. But spatial reasoning ultimately has to do with like affecting concrete reality. But yeah, it's one of those things where, you know, and then you see this where it's like magical thinking, where people like Ms. Bridges, the lawyer, if they just say something enough and repeat it and chant it, they can change reality itself. They can change the base nature of reality. It's like a form of incantation. And this is something, and I'm curious if anyone else has noticed this. When I see people talk using woke buzzwords, they have a very strange speech pattern. If you've ever, next time you hear someone talk about diversity, equity, inclusion, or use any other language type of buzzwords or phrases that you see a lot of the, you know, diversity, inclusion, equity people using, all the woke buzzword stuff, they kind of get this weird like chant. It almost sounds like they're casting a magical spell, and it's kind of, it's always kind of felt a little disturbing to me. Like, it's just, if someone wants to speak about topics, woke topics, they change their voice. They have this weird little sing-song chant when they speak. I mean, they're speaking, like, normally, but it's like their voice patterns changes slightly. And it's just kind of unusual. I don't know if you ever noticed that. Have you ever paid attention to that?
Well, yes. What will happen is they'll start to talk about trans women are women, and they will have this cadence to it, this particular, instead of, you know, if you notice the way I'm talking, right, I can say trans women are women, but they don't say trans women are women, they say trans women are women. It's this chant. It happens, you know, both from, I believe there's a few phenomena that might explain it. Ultimately, it's very difficult to say, you know, chicken egg, but one comes from the idea that essentially activism comes from chanting in streets, and so they learn these kinds of chants, and they learn this kind of cadence. And then secondarily, and these things feed into each other. These are difficult concepts, many of them somewhat contradictory in all this. And so being able to keep track of trans women are women, or trans women give birth, or trans women, it's not trans women, trans people, birth giving people, trying to keep track of where you are. Mnemonic device, by being able to chant it in such a sing-song way, makes you able to remember it. How many people can actually recite ABCs without resorting to song? A, B, C, D versus A, B, C, D, E, F. How many people can rattle that off without cadence? And so I think part of it is that, frankly, it's a difficult, strange thing to remember, and so it helps them keep track of it and make sure that they don't lose out on it. Plus, other people do it too, and it becomes this, you know, going back to the idea of egregor, which is a sort of a collective idea that gets stronger and stronger by people feeding into it.
Yeah, I've noticed, like, you know, especially when I was still in San Francisco, you would hear people talk like that, but it was their affect would change and it would get slightly flat and they would start to speed up and chant it a little bit when they were saying it. Even if this was like a relatively small group of people, when they were discussing these topics, it was like they switched into this other person. It was, I don't want to say demonic because that's not really quite the word, but it was one of those things of almost like a casting a spell, so to speak.
Well, they're possessed, perhaps.
It's definitely possessed, but it's just it's sort of very strange when you look at it. So much of going back to the word cell shape rotator thing, and this is something that we've really seen over the last couple decades. It's like we've offshoring manufacturing, financialization of the economy, and so much of the economy we have today is abstractions. It's about, if you're going to sell mortgage-backed securities and so it will just buy insurance, collateralize debt obligations on these things, and it makes them good as new, and they're triple-A rated, and we'll sell these in the economy because we say it is, and they end up crashing and tanking. And the law is kind of the same way in a sense. It's a lot of words, and it's almost like people look for the right incantation to get the outcome they want. It's sort of weird for me to look at it and see. It's like, as the country has become more secular and as, or technically secular, as the Christianity and public life has receded, you see this almost strangely pagan and primitive superstitious behavior start to raise again in the public sphere. Whether if it's this corruption of blood mindset that's behind so much awokeness, where it's like you're responsible for the sins of your ancestors, and people have to chant to, the racist spirits, which is like, it's interesting because so much of the, when they talk about systemic racism, it sounds like in the old days when they used to talk about, there was this thing called the ether, which was the theory of what planets floated in. It's like no one could really explain how like matter floated in space, so, and how things were transmitted through space. So they just kind of assumed it was kind of a stopgap, like, yeah, there's this thing called ether and everything floats in that, and the sound waves and microwaves and x-rays all travel through this because that's the medium that transmits this stuff. And that's kind of like, I remember there was that clip from Adam Carolla and Gavin Newsom where Newsom's talking about 10 years ago, and he's talking about why minorities can't get bank accounts, and Adam Carolla's like, why? Why? And he's just like driving him insane because he couldn't give him an answer, and he kept like trying to get state plainly what Newsom was saying. Then Newsom would get angry and try to switch it to something else. But yeah, it's one of those things of what else do you think? I'm sorry, I'm kind of following a train of thoughts here, and we're kind of switching to a little bit for this one to be a little bit more casual, conversational. Set up here. Where do you
Right,
want to go?
right. Well, and what's linked to that other that Twitter fight essentially of where there was they were having a march for this slain man, and they were trying to make it about police violence and that overreacting, and it was a man, I guess, was shooting through his wall, and he ne like nearly shot someone, so there was standoff with police for 6 hours. I guess snipers shot him or something like that after a 6 hour standoff, and so they were like marching for justice for whoever, and this was in Minneapolis, I guess, and so a woman who was in the house, who was in the adjacent apartment that he was shooting into, came out to the people that were marching for justice, and she said, this is like, and she started breaking down about nearly being shot in front of her children, and she has people telling her, well, you weren't shot, and you don't have a right to do this, and there were people trying to contact, there were sort of white liberals trying to contextualize. She is, of course, a person of color, and the person who died, person of color, a difference. But you have white liberals trying to contextualize and say, oh, she's upset, she's these kinds of things, trying to contextualize it. But you see this real clash of reality about, do you have a right to protest? Do you have a right to be angry or be upset about being shot in an apartment next door? And do you have a right to demand to support police for shooting an active threat? And again, this goes to a lack of moral, a lack of moral agreement, right? If we can't agree that someone that's an active threat, shooting at people, nearly killing you, if we can't agree that this person, this person has forfeited life and can be validly shot in self defense, or can be validly shot by people that are in the public defense, like police and all that, then we don't have a moral foundation. We don't have a similar moral agreement. And until one side triumphs, all that there is conflict. It's all over, but, it's all over but the fighting at this point, essentially.
Yeah. It's one of the things where it's just a recognition of what already exists, and less so something that we're trying to force on reality as far as, the divisions in American society. And again, this is one of the things where I was kind of talking about where, I think one of the assumptions people have about splitting up is like, we're going to leave. And I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. Like, no, first of all, it's like, why would we want to succeed? It's like, we're not the people who hate America. We're not the people who are talking about it's irredeemably racist. Let's make them leave. And plus too, you look back at history again, we've got object examples of this. If you try to leave, not everyone who wants to leave is going to be allowed to leave with you. So you're automatically going to be at a disadvantage. Like, you look at, the Civil War, it's like Maryland and Kentucky weren't allowed to leave. And I think, even Missouri, like they couldn't go. And there was states who wanted to go. So it was like it was most of the states that wanted to leave, but it was not all of them. So again, you're at a huge disadvantage right there, because the states that are naturally allied with you are forced to remain in the old construct. And then again, you have to start over with foreign policy and everything. And that was a big thing. The South couldn't get any backing from other countries. So, I mean, again, looking at that, whoever leaves, in my perspective, is going to be at a disadvantage, which is why I think we need to try to, I'm going to write something about this. I've been sketching it out, working out all my concepts on it. But yeah, let's make them leave. They think if America's irredeemably racist and they want to get away from the flyover chuds and start fresh, then let's make some of the big blue states bail.
Well, and I think it's very ironic, it's cherry on top of sundae that you have Clarence Thomas, who has long been my favorite justice. He's a real American. Like, it's I don't wish to get misty-eyed, apple pie, all this kind of ridiculous Americana stuff, but he's a real American in most real sense. His idea of vacation is taking his boomer wife out on RV, on RV trips across America. He fixes issues with an RV. Imagine a Supreme Court justice taking an RV and wanting to go camp in Walmart parking lots. This is literal real man, and so this is literally who he is, and so he's writing about originalism. And unlike Scalia, who wrote these very flowery, florid, wonderful, poetic rulings, but basically gave in on many issues, Thomas does not. And frankly, to put it squarely there, he's a black man writing about originalism, whereas the idea is a black man cannot write about originalism because it would consign him to a second-class status. Whereas Thomas is actually demonstrating that no, it does not consign you to a second-class status. No, you don't. You can't do that kind of thing. There's so much fear of being called racist as far as things go. Thomas does not care about this. And so the thing is, Thomas is really actually showing the way for the moral foundations for the right, as well as the intellectual foundations for the right, to argue for true American originalism, with, of course, again, modifications with 14th Amendment, modifications of banning slavery. Yes, of course, these things are modified, but going to, what the founders would have had as idea, updating with slight modifications compared to saying, well, we completely invalidate anything founders thought. We completely get rid of that, what they think is irrelevant. Ezra Klein was giving talk and talking about how he can't even take seriously the idea of originalism, the idea of 20-year-old clerks, looking up history and this being a basis for law. He was almost spitting at his disgust of the idea of it. But the thing is, Clarence Thomas has made it not only valid, he has made it the ruling law of land, and he has breathed a life into it and breathed a legitimacy into it by actually unapologetically doing it and showing the origins of text, history, and tradition, which is the test that was laid down for Dobbs, the test that was laid down for Bruin, and this is the world we live in. And the thing is, that is America. And in fact, he's actually staking out what America can be, what America should be. And frankly, I think all the right needs to say is, yeah, that's exactly correct. And if you don't like it, you are free to leave. But this is how it is. Take it or leave it. America, love it or leave it. And you can leave it. We will give you a good deal. We will work this out. But, you know, as I said, it's about having the moral courage and moral conviction to be able to be like this woman out there who is absolutely going after and saying, how dare you say that, like, my life does not matter, that me being shot in front of my kids does not matter. How dare you? And, you know, this is, again, and part of the reason I want to talk about it was, you know, the thing is, there's this confirmation bias, and this is part of the talk, confirmation bias that clearly Josh Hawley won. And that's what I'm saying. There, you know, depending on, you know, people have different interpretations, and we don't actually know if Josh Hawley won that interaction, because what has happened from it? Is it fundraising? Is whoever fundraised more good for it? I mean, you know, has UC Berkeley lost student enrollment? Is Josh Hawley actually sanctioning UC Berkeley Law School? Is he actually going after endowment? Is he trying to take away federal funding for research projects? Without there being concrete harms for doing these things, and actually consequences for such things, then I can't see that you can say that a senator and one of the leading, most intelligent, young, and frankly presidential caliber Republicans, one of the bright shining stars of Republican Party, if he can't win versus a UC Berkeley leftist law professor saying that, you know, that that men give birth and that he's killing people by denying this, if he can't clearly win for all sides, then you have a much deeper foundation, and it's important to actually take a step back from your side that your normalcy bias and see, is he actually winning concrete victories off of this? Again, going back to what DeSantis does, you know, he actually makes people pay costs for things, just like left made the right pay costs for trying to for the trans bathroom thing years back. You know, Mike Pence had to go back on this kind of thing with LinkedIn and all these things. It's anyways. That makes sense.
Yeah. I think it's important, you know, again, you have to make the opposing side pay costs. It's again, and this is funny because so many people, I'm seeing so many of the activists left get angry now because so many of the Congress people are fundraising off of a lot of the stuff that they're losing. They're like, what the fuck is wrong with you? You know, you have a trifecta in government. And the right's getting everything they want. And again, that's something that I think is very important. It's easy to look at people are geared so that they focus more on the negative things than the positive. Because, you know, again, I assume there's some evolutionary aspect to it. Because if you focus on fixing the bad things versus just consoling yourself with all the good things that you have happening, you know, you'll never fix the bad things. But, yeah, you know, the left is doing so much of the stuff that the right's moaning about, the left is doing, and they're like, they have a sense that the right always gets what it wants, which we know is not true, but at the same time, you know, we've had a huge victory with gun rights this year, you know, Roe v. Wade is gone, which is something no one ever imagined was going to happen anytime soon, but they managed to pull it off, and again, that was something the right did, but they put in effort over decades to make it happen. It wasn't about the big clash and the big victory, and there's just, you know, you win everything in one showing, and there's like, no, you put in the effort and you work hard and you win. And I think that's a lesson to take for the right for everything else, is like, you know, it's about consistency. Like, that's interesting because the pro-life side was one of the sides that I've seen, probably the most notable side on the right that has fought like the left in terms of having those protests, you know, people that are fairly experienced at having a protest, at understanding the limits on how you can protest, like how and the tactics you can use and where you can do it and how to apply it, but also like how to fight through the institutions and how to build effective organizations.
Right. Well, and it's, you know, let us be very clear. Humongous success of pro-life about how few Eric Rudolphs there were. This is 50 years. This is considered, you know, mass slaughter, you know, on level of world wars, essentially, of, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands dead every year. And yet the lack of, you know, screw your optics, I'm going in type radicals killing people and doing things, the complete lack of that. Yes, you have Eric Rudolph doing so. And you have the people that shot abortionists down in church and all this. You have a few of these elements, but the quiet moral confidence of position, the quiet moral confidence, the ability to strongly look people in the eye and say, that's not who we are, that's not what we do, that's not how we win it, and to actually be able to sell that to normal people that in fact in many cases disagreed with them, but the sheer moral conviction and ability to communicate this, tremendous success about the truly moral position. And, you know, like I said, for, you know, gun rights, I would say as something very strong in America and all this, I say it's going to start needing to look at how to retool, because the recent victory in Bruin was about public carry, about being able to carry firearms in case of confrontation in public. This is an incredibly strong moral foundation in terms of, again, if you're being attacked, what are you supposed to do? If you're a weak woman, if you're a 110-pound woman attacked by a 200-pound man, you know, as you know, as they say, God made men, you know, God created men equal, Sam Colt made men equal. Without an equalizing tool, how can a woman oppose this kind of thing? There's a strong moral argument to be made for public carry. It's very evident, and gun rights has, I believe, succeeded in making this position. You have the woman who at the Luby's cafeteria in Texas who had to watch her, I think it was her, watch both her parents be shot down, and she had a gun in the car, left it in the car because it was no carry at that point, giving the testimony to the Texas hearing of some sort. You have these incredibly strong moral things like that you can make a very strong case for such things. And so I think public carry was that kind of thing. Now, moving forward with trying to liberalize laws on, you know, what are called assault weapons or semi-automatic rifles and all this, trying to get rid of NFA, these kinds of things, I don't know if the gun rights has actually managed to make the same moral case for such things. And without the same moral case and that same moral confidence, I don't know if you'll see the same success. You know, I think that's an incredibly important thing, to actually have the moral argument, to have the moral conviction, and to be able to make the case easily like that. You know, it's you know, you can see that both sides thought they had the moral right of it. And like I say, it's not, you know, the right likes to talk about the left in delegitimizing terms, and the other side, and the left does too, but the right doesn't see it. When the right says, look at this woman, she says that men can give birth, and that, you know, it's that giving birth is not a woman's issue. But that's not how the left describes themselves. They say that Josh Hawley is killing people. Josh Hawley is killing people, and by denying trans people exist. Now, he's not denying they exist. He's not denying that people have these ideas and do these things. But by denying their self-conception, he's killing them. And so they're making a moral argument that if you don't accept their position, you're a murderer. It's a crazy position, but it is a consistent position to give them the moral high ground. And this is what they always scramble for. And so it sounds ridiculous and all this, but if you don't take away the moral high ground from such things, you know, you're headed for a very bad time.
I think that's an excellent point. And that's one, you know, I kind of touched on before, but I think you made a really full-throated, strong defense on it, which is, again, you know, you can't just focus on making economic arguments or practical arguments. You have to ultimately make a moral argument, because the person who wins, like the way you win in politics and the culture, is you make it, you tell a morality play, and you trick your opponent into playing the bad guy in it. And it's the person, it's about, you know, to steal from like the pickup artist people, they talk about like frame, you know, it's about sticking to your frame, you know, the or and that's something you see in a lot. Like you said, Steven Jobs was that. Like it's not even really like something the pickup artist dudes do. It's like literally, if you want to succeed in anything, if you can hold a frame and make everyone else bend to your frame, Steven Jobs is notorious for
Well,
that.
I knew a ridiculous lefty young woman years ago who was cousin of a man named George Lakoff, who was a Democratic consultant, and he wrote a book literally called On Framing, or Framing is I believe the term, and he talks about framing issues, and you have to frame the issue in a particular way, and it's all about framing. This came about during the George W. Bush era, and you know, Lakoff was supposed to be the great way to defeat George W. Bush by refusing to engage in the frames. So, and this was like, you know, total shit-lid lefty, you know, very not pickup artist type. So yes, and this is something the left has well understood. I think this is what you see with abortion radicalism. Well, you know, you have people like Tim Pool featuring people talking about that they support abortion right up until the moment of birth or even post-birth and all this. And why is that? Because George, you know, because they see that Bill Clinton, with Triangulation Expert, they see him basically giving up the abortion issue by saying it should be safe, legal, and rare, which is admitting that there's something shameful about it. And so you have people like Lena Dunham saying she wish she had an abortion to try to make aborting a moral good. And again, it's about struggling for that. And like I said, it's people want there to be compromise. People want there to be peace. I get wanting there to be peace. You know, Yugoslavia was a peaceful place kept in place by dictator who, you know, occasionally used savagery, but used savagery to keep bigger savagery away. Okay? Like it that was moral calculus. It did work. But at the end of the day, sometimes people will not do that. You know, they're, you know, look at gay marriage. Gay marriage was not, let us have civil unions. You know, the thing is, people missed with Gavin Newsom. They said, oh, he really believes in gay marriage and he's handing out this in 2004. He's really who kicked things off by handing out marriage permits in San Francisco against law, and he was shut down from that. And so what happens is he starts handing out marriage permits to gay couples against law. There's injunction, all this kind of stuff. But he's saying, look, I'm disobeying law for moral righteousness, right? And so then you have and then eventually, you know, this really kickstarts the modern gay marriage kind of thing. There was no one that ever said, you know, why don't we actually get rid of marriage permits altogether? Why don't we stop get marriage, you know, take the libertarian position, take the moral equivocation out of it. Let's rescind marriages. Let's strike all marriage words from certificates. Let's everything a civil union. Government no longer does marriages. Everyone has civil unions, and so gays can have civil unions, straights can have civil unions, you know, people that are non-gendered can have civil unions. Everyone can have civil unions. Government is not making a moral judgment on marriage, which is defined as a religious thing. Let's just hand out these things.
Yeah, I think one of the things that happened with that is it's interesting because the frame part, you know, it's it that's all, the civil union thing ended up kind of being a frame mistake as with the talking about safe, legal, and rare, because the basic frame is about it's about ceding the frame to the opponent. Like, yeah, we're in a what we're doing is wrong, but we just kind of think it's maybe not the worst thing. And I think both of those are examples of that. One thing too, with the civil rights era, it's so much of the civil rights era was based around the idea of you had people going out there and protesting, but it was a multi-dimensional thing. Like people were out there, number one, they believed without a doubt that what they were doing was the morally correct thing. Secondly, you know, they had people on the ground who were doing activism and protesting and stuff like that. But then they also had the lawfare aspect of it too. So it was a multi-dimensional attack. And you saw this with the abortion issue as well. So I'm going to wrap this up here. Is there anything you want to add? Last little thoughts?
Yeah, just last little thoughts. You know, sometimes you have to understand when when you can actually have a productive conversation because you guys share a reality, share a conclusion, and share something that you can agree upon. And then when you simply cannot, you know, and this is the thing. It's, you know, if you know, when you're dealing, and the thing is, people, you know, and the right is used to this, okay, I can't have conversation with them because they're a toddler, and they're just tired, and we just need to let them go to sleep and all this. But it's a little more difficult than that. It's frankly something that the left is actually used to dealing with in large cities. They have crazy people on streets, and they're used to living with them, and they're used to walking around them, and they're used to coexisting with people that do not share same reality. The right likes to live a more orderly way without this kind of thing. And God bless, it is much more fun way to live. But you actually have to realize, maybe they actually are not toddlers. Maybe they actually are adults and actually can do something to you if they don't share your frame of reference.